My dear friends, insecurity is the historic partner of Jewish survival. Kol harada shamanu, pachad, ve'in shalom. We heard a voice of trembling fear and not of peace. In the near past, this people Israel seemed finally to have escaped the voice of trembling. Danger seemed to recede. The tide withdrew only to return. Fedayeen marauders of 1955 and 1956 vanished for a time after the Suez campaign, only to reappear as the El Fatah terrorists of the last several years. The wilderness of Sinai emptied of troops after Suez bristles now again with Egyptian armies and Russian arms, the murder-loving marauders of the Palestine Liberation Organization. Last week, the final fragile symbol of a more peaceful time was removed. A peremptory order from Cairo, reinforced by a few warning shots over the heads of the United Nations Emergency Force in Gaza, led to their hasty withdrawal. The voice of hate blew away the last veil of restraint. Syria is ready for the liberation operation to explode Zionist existence. The voice is that of Baghdad's defense minister. The time has come to be rid of the Zionist cancer in Palestine. The voice is that of the Vice Premier of Iraq. The time has come to put an end to Israel's policy of bombast and conceit. The voice of that is that of Marshal Amr, the commander of Egyptian forces facing Israel. Jackal men today pant for blood and howl for war. Ahmed Zoukiri gleefully promises sabotage and terror will begin again. These shrill voices of trembling send a shiver down our souls, for they rip away the illusion, the comfortable, comforting illusion, that this world is fundamentally sane, that man is fundamentally reasonable. The Dark Ages are still with us, their mouths parched with a thirst for vengeance. Arab men and women chant the blood cries and sanctify black hate. Ugly passion and simple viciousness is transformed into that ultimate anomaly, jihad, the so-called holy war. And so the terror of life is again upon us. And as always, we have come to our synagogue for encouragement and wisdom. Terror at least has this virtue, it heightens our perception. We see more clearly now that pathology we otherwise prefer to deny. We can admit now the simple truth. That Israel confronts madness. That Israel is exposed to men and nations whose actions are impelled by dark and malignant passions, uncensored by conscience and indifferent to principle. The Arab world is possessed of all the furies of hate. I've heard it so often in recent days that the danger in the Middle East lies in political miscalculation. The danger in the Middle East lies in the fact that one side or another will play its cards too cavalierly, that there will be a confrontation which cannot be compromised. In the normal course of that constant political challenge, which is usually called diplomacy, miscalculation is the danger. And indeed, there is peril that a random shot in Gaza or the exacerbated temper of a sergeant in the Galilean hills may lead to war. But I would submit that the real peril is not miscalculation, it is madness. The real peril lies in not recognizing that the enemy is not fully master of his own actions, but possessed by overwhelming and at times uncontrollable passions. Madness, as you well know, sweeps away reason. Madness is deaf to conscience. Madness will not be satisfied with face-saving negotiations. Craftily and steadily, it plans and proceeds towards its set and fixed objective. Only restraint, only forcible restraint can deter it from its course. The usual diplomatic practice of compromise and quiet arrangements is meaningless before the thrust of this demonic possession. Indeed, how meaningless have all the negotiations and all the conferences and all the meetings held over the past 20 years in the Middle East been. How many times in the past 19 years has Israel offered peace to its neighbors? How many times in the last 19 years has Israel offered to sign a non-aggression pact? How many times in the last 19 years has Israel offered to adjudicate all the outstanding disputes? How many times has Israel pledged its word that it has no territorial ambitions? How many times has the United Nations or our own government cautioned and admonished Arab monomania? Yet here we are, after 19 years of cold war and constant blockade, after a dozen years of infiltration and murder and sabotage, after 10 years of accelerated arms race at the very brink of war, madness sweeps aside reason, and madness laughs at the advice of cautious men. It has only one purpose, and nothing will deter its achieving that end. Let us be clear on this. Israel has offered peace. Israel offers peace. Nasser has demanded war. Nasser demands war. Israel has proffered negotiations. Israel proffers negotiations. Nasser refused compromise. Nasser refuses compromise. Israel has taken military action only to defend its homes and its cities when these were under attack by an aggressive policy or threatened by a massive buildup of enemy forces. If war comes to the Middle East, it will not come because of miscalculation, because the nations there have somehow played the game of bluff, of dare and double dare, and one or the other has failed to keep the rules. It will come because the Arab world is a world possessed. It will come because the Arab world is a maddened world which can dream the nightmare dreams of reducing Israel to a sea of blood, of driving the Yishuv into the sea. Now, civilized societies have long since learned that insanity needs to be quarantined, that madmen need to be institutionalized. The possessed need to be controlled for their own sake and for the sake of society. It's a very simple and ordinary practice to take from these troubled folk the simplest implements with which they might harm themselves or others. Yet incredibly, the great powers of the world have spent the better part of the last 20 years plying the hate-maddened with ever more powerful weapons of carnage. Instead of an embargo and arms, instead of quarantine and military purchase, Russia and the United States have competed with each other in providing the Nassers and the El Abtasis and the Husseins and the Faisals with sophisticated missiles and supersonic warplanes with heavy tanks and heavy armor. Can anyone now be surprised that madmen are in the streets brandishing these weapons and threatening not only the object of their fury and of their frenzy, but the passerby, the entire world? For the last 20 years, Russia and the United States have engaged in an unceasing global rivalry. Their policies and economic ambitions have made it expedient for them to blind themselves to the obvious truth, known to any child, that it is the ultimate act of irresponsibility to give dynamite to a madman. Such senseless acts cannot abide his friendship nor advance your interests, for madness has no other interest save its primary fixation. Tonight at Gaza and at Sharm el-Sheikh, the confrontation is not a simple confrontation between Israel and Egypt. 20 years of international intrigue and 15 years of arms peddling have inextricably involved Moscow and Washington in the Middle East. For 20 years, Israel has asked these capitals to extend multinational guarantees to the area. Eager to outbid one another for Arab ports and Arab oil, the superpowers have vacillated, procrastinated, and delayed. East-West multinational guarantees which could bring peace and security to the area do not exist. And Israel has had to arm itself over the past 20 years against the avalanche of weapons which have been thrust by the great powers upon the Arab states. She has pleaded for effective restraint. The foreign ministries of the world have agreed that such a policy was advisable, but restraint has not been imposed. The great powers have substituted temporization for policy, and their weakness and their indecision has only fed the flames of Arab ambition and silenced the few voices of reason within the Arab world. The demagogue needs only to point to the kowtowing of the great powers as proof of his own power and of his omniscience. And so tonight, Israel quite properly calls upon Russia and the United States to recognize their complicity in this crisis and to acknowledge that even greater dangers are implicit. For if war breaks out in the Middle East, the fragile pattern of East-West coexistence will be ripped to shreds. Can the free world permit Israel to become another Czechoslovakia or Poland? Can the Soviet Union permit the Middle East to become the graveyard of its policy of coexistence? So often in our history, the future of Israel has become a concern not only in and of itself, but one which is symbolic and symptomatic of all the dangers that threaten civilization. In recent years, the Soviet Union has spoken often and again about normalizing international relations, about her desire for peaceful coexistence. $2.5 billion worth of arms sent to Egypt in the last 5 years and $1 billion worth of arms sent to Syria belie these professions. But it was argued that Russia could exert a restraining force and voice in Cairo and Baghdad. If these words were indeed more than a calculated deceit, then I submit that a time is past due to call up these debts and to exercise this breaking force. Russia stands to lose by the confrontation now taking place in the Middle East. She stands to lose whatever modicum of sympathy she has built up these past years in the world. She stands to lose because she will be brought to an East-West confrontation which can hardly be to hers or to anyone's advantage. Russia in the last years has snubbed Israel internationally. She has financed the armies of the United Arab Republic, Syria, and Iraq. She has used Radio Moscow and her embassies to circulate Arab venom. She has backed every Arab machination in the United Nations. She has proclaimed before the fact Israel to be the aggressor in the present confrontation. She has catered to the madness and insanity of her maddened friends. These passions now threaten her larger interests. One looks to Russia, hopefully, against hope really, for the wisdom of Tashkent. But one finds as yet tonight only the unbending calculation of the Cold War. Our own nation has played a more balanced and in many ways an equally short-sighted role in the Middle East. Time and again, despite our better wisdom, we have catered to Arab whim, bowed to Arab threat. In 1956, we pledged freedom of passage through the Suez Canal, only to renege on that pledge when Nasser would not bend. In 1950, we pledged ourselves to oppose force and the threat of force in the Middle East, yet we have remained effectively silent during the long years of sabotage and insurgency. For almost a decade, we supplied Nasser with arms, and when this military aid became unpalatable to the American public, we continued to provide Egypt with economic aid which freed Nasser's treasury to buy his arms elsewhere. Deaf to the lesson of Kashmir, we underwrote and still underwrite the army of Jordan. We send and are sending modern weapons to Saudi Arabia. It was our plan that these weapons be used against Nasser's revolutionary subversion. Yet today, Saudi Arabia and Jordan rush to the battlefront and join the bloody chorus, ready to use our arms against a professed American ally. American policy in the Middle East has equivocated and mistemporized, yet it must be said that it has remained overtly friendly to Israel, and it has recognized not only the imperative of peace, but the value, the necessity of supporting the one true democracy in that part of the world. Had we been firmer in our convictions, we might have brought stability before this time. But at least we have been constant in our profession of friendship. These last few years, America has finally sold Israel with some weapons, and the guarantee of borders in the area remains a commitment of our national policy. The United States has recognized, and as yesterday's State Department pronouncements re-emphasized, recognizes that if the rule of law and of international order breaks down in the Middle East, it may and probably will be only a matter of time before it breaks down the world over. But the critical question remains unanswered. Will we act? Under what provocation? How? When? The White House until this evening was preternaturally quiet during these crisis days. One wonders even with the statement of this evening, with its rather broad description of American policy, whether Cairo may not discount our commitments and bank on our indecision. Such a judgment in Cairo could, of course, have catastrophic consequences. Some questions must be asked. What does the White House and what does the State Department acknowledge precisely our commitments to be in the area? effective response will our government make to Mr. Nather's some thumb-nosing at our 1957 guarantee of the right of passage through the Straits of Tiran? If we look to our government for an effective response, we ask no more than for action on pledges and commitments made again and again these past 19 years. We look for a response which might give pause to an aggressor before he takes the step that can never be recalled. If we look to our government to support vigorously and effectively the integrity and safety of Israel, we really ask only that America understands its complicity in the present crisis. American Jews ask for no special favors for Israel, but that our government recognize that its strength in the community of nations lies in the confidence that the decent and the peace-loving peoples have placed in the American word. We have assured these small nations that they will never be again be sacrificed at a Munich. Will Gaza then become the Munich of the Third World War? America has recognized that one cannot appease an aggressor, that after the little nations have been gobbled up, the larger confrontation is unavoidable. What we ask of our government is that it acts now on this certain knowledge. American Jews do not ask for special favors for Israel, only that America recognize its stake in the larger battle, the battle of reason against madness, the battle of decency against deviltry. In light of this awareness, this country undertook those commitments in 1950 and reaffirmed them ever since. In 1950, to restrain Egypt and Syria and Jordan, we pledged ourselves, along with England and France, to counter aggression or the threat of force in the Middle East. In 1957, the United States promised to maintain the basic principle that no nation might close an international waterway to another. Twice in his administration, President Johnson has reaffirmed that commitment. The honesty of these commitments, their integrity, and their effect is now at stake. If Nasser closes the Straits of Tehran, will American destroyer shepherd Israeli ships to Eilat? If the Palestine Liberation Organization makes a travesty of the border, will the United States see that a peacekeeping force of our own or of the United Nations is landed? These are the questions. The questions which we must ask our government to make. To a nation burdened by Vietnam, any further commitment of our power must seem taxing, if not dangerous. But can it be avoided? Will we not make a mockery of all commitments if we do not respond to the present threat? When madness is abroad, no man and no nation is secure. If violence rules the world, what future is there for any man or any nation? Prime Minister Lvivenko has made to the world a most generous offer. He not only has reasserted Israel's consistent and sustained desire for peace, but he has offered to withdraw Israeli troops from the border zone if Egypt will only do the same. Our government ought energetically to pursue this possibility. A major step in that direction would be a clear restatement of the American decision not to sit quietly by as the match draws closer and closer to the tinder, as if we were somehow hoping to find a rationalization for inaction. Let Nasser know that all the dictators and demagogues of the world know that they must face not only the courage of a little nation, but the convictions and the power of a great nation. Let Nasser know that he will not only face Israel's courage, but the Sixth Fleet. Let him know that war will not only wound Israel, but destroy him and badly punish his nation. Such, I believe, is the message that we must bring before the conscience of our nation. Let us make clear to our friends and to our community that Israel seeks no special favors, only the honoring of long-standing and well-conceived commitments. Let us make clear to our community and to the Congress and to the White House that we understand the larger implications of this conflict. That we understand that the good name, the good will of the United States are deeply involved, and that in a significant way, the hope of peace in our world lies in the balance. Meet then with those that you can. Explain to those who are innocent and unaware. Write, telephone to those in posts of authority. The time calls for action. Not only for the sake of Israel, but for the sake of this country and of mankind. And security, dear friends, has been the constant partner of Israel through our long history. There have been black hours before, and our people has never wavered. There is reason for anxiety at this hour, but not for despair. Our strength has not yet begun to be counted. The protection of God has not yet begun to be seen. Yet there is reason for concern, and there is reason for action. Fret not thyself of the evildoer, but cry aloud the truth, and speak abroad what needs to be said. That Israel stands for civilization, and that war threatens us all. Amen.